Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and my next guest argues that all the same things that seem to terrify economists, global trade, outsourcing, mass production, AI, are actually good for workers who want to realize their passions and do what they want. Many of you know Adam Davidson as a New Yorker staff writer or co-founder of NPR's Planet Money. He's also the CEO of the podcast production company Three Uncanny Four, and he is the author now of a new book called The Passion Economy, The New Rules for Thriving in the 21st Century. Hey, Adam, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. It's always great to be here.
So we shouldn't be afraid of robots taking our jobs?
Well, it is funny because so much of my work, I mean, I've been on your show many times, I always love coming on, has been talking about sort of terrifying and awful things in our economy. And I certainly don't disown any of that work that I've done. I do think that there's major dislocation that's causing very real pain and creating some winners and many losers. But in all my reporting, first at NPR, at Planet Money, and then at the New York Times Magazine, then at the New Yorker, I became aware that there are people who are thriving now despite or even really because of so many of the things that are causing pain. And I began to see them as two sides of the same disruption, that we're going through a massive change. And one side effect of that is people are left behind. I think you could argue even the Trump phenomenon is a side effect of this massive change from a 20th century sort of widget mass production economy to the new economy we're in now. But that just like any major change, like going from agriculture to industry, there are losers, but there are also winners, and there are new rules, new ways of winning. So I've devoted 20 years to misery, and this is my shot at some happy news.
So the passion economy. Does that mean that there are certain jobs that somehow can be framed that way, that are the winning jobs, or people who become, you know, employed by winning jobs in this context?
I mean, I'd say it's something I find in pretty much every industry. It's something I find I tell the story of some Amish farming manufacturers, of a guy in Long Island who makes brushes, of a whole host of people who you wouldn't think of as passion businesses. It's really an approach to figuring out your place in the economy. It's how do I find those things that are uniquely, that I can do uniquely well, and find an audience out there that wants it. In fact, for me, one of the formative thoughts is our industry, that shifting from my own personal career, shifting from broadcast journalism to podcasting is a perfect example, where broadcast is, you know, when I worked at NPR, you create content that's then broadcast to member stations all over the country. And you sort of need to have content that 80-year-olds in Alabama and 23-year-olds in San Francisco will like, but that when I shifted to podcasting, you're able to bring more of yourself. You're able to be more specific to the audience that pulls you in. And interestingly, on the financial side, on the economic side, the economics are just much more compelling for passion. So even though, say, for example, Planet Money would do podcasts and would do stuff on the radio, mm-hmm. the podcast would reach a tiny fraction of the people, but we made so much more money because those listeners are very engaged. But now, I want to say, even though, Brian, you're a broadcaster, you are a person who is living this. You are a very authentic and real person.
I'm a podcaster, too.
And you are a podcaster, too.
But aren't you and I terrible examples, because we are among the lucky few who have gotten to, you know, live our dreams, if you want to call it that, of having successful journalism careers, whereas most people have much more limited prospects, and so this should really be framed much differently?
So you and I probably are terrible examples for a whole host of reasons, yes. But let me quickly tell you about Lance Cheney, who is out in Long Island. He runs Braun Brush, his family's brush manufacturing mm-hmm. business. And their story up until 10 years ago or so, was the story we've heard a million times. They make brushes. They happen to be specialists in brushes for the food industry. One of their biggest products was a pizza oven cleaning brush. So that's a tricky thing. You want it to be rough enough to scratch away gunk, but not so rough that it ruins the surface. You don't want any bristles falling out and getting in people's pizza. And they had a pretty standard 20th century small manufacturing business. They made as many brushes as they could, as fast and cheaply as they could, and sold them as much as they could. And then Chinese companies started exporting competitive brushes, started really hurting their industry. And they were heading towards the story we've heard a million times. Chinese manufacturing, they couldn't keep up. China was exporting finished brushes that cost less than the raw materials. There's no way to make a profit. And Lance, after having a very pleasant fight with his dad, he loved his dad very much. He always asks me to point that out. But his dad was stuck in the 20th century model. And Lance said, no, we're not going to compete with China. We're going to create brush solutions for companies that don't even realize maybe they have a brush problem. And so he decided, we're not going to make any brushes that compete with China. We're only going to make new brushes that solve some specific problem. He created an amazing brush that is used in inspecting and cleaning nuclear power plants. He created a brush that's on Mars for NASA, on the Mars rover, to wipe away dust and debris when they're inspecting rocks. And he's able to take a very, I mean, not just 20th century, like a 19th century industry, what's more basic than brushes, and really transform it, not through high technology or venture capital, just transform it into a very successful business, because he's focused on how do I solve problems for people who maybe don't even realize a brush can solve
more
that problem.
Niche economy opportunities.
Yeah, I balk at the word niche because I think niche is a byproduct of the 20th century widget world, where there's sort of, you know, Procter and Gamble's making a million bars of Ivory soap, and then maybe there's some specialized niche. This is more, I mean, maybe niche is the right word, but this is more an ongoing relationship with those customers who most need the thing that you uniquely can provide. That's true also for people who work in a company, that I think if you think of the classic 20th century business, your job was to just do the function of whatever your title was, bookkeeper or draftsperson. And now I think more and more you need to show, I'm not like everyone else. I have something unique and something valuable that nobody else can bring to the table.
You say niche. Somebody says niche.
I do say niche, but you said niche. I
said
niche.
We can have that debate another day.
Yeah.
So let's take another example. You profiled a person who's operating in the passion economy as an accountant, Jason Bloomer. You wouldn't traditionally put passion and accounting together, maybe. So how did he make it into your book?
And Jason says niche. He's very adamant. That's actually true. He says it like every 5 seconds. Yeah. And he never even heard of niche. He's from, and Jason's a perfect example. So I made a point in this book of not, I consume a lot of business books. I hate that they're all written as if you, every reader, is going to be the CEO of a Fortune 500 company, or they're going to raise $1 billion in Silicon Valley and become a venture capitalist. I think most people are interested in what Silicon Valley dismissively, or business schools dismissively, call lifestyle businesses. So I wanted to find people who had regular stories. These weren't people who were born geniuses, went to Harvard, went to Stanford Business School. These were regular folks without a lot of money, without a lot of obvious advantage. And none of them really would call themselves geniuses. They're not geniuses. They're people who just kind of figured a few things out. And Jason is such a great example. If you met him at 25, there's probably no one you would be less impressed with. He had been a bassist for a very mediocre Christian heavy metal band, but that failed. And then
Two phrases you don't hear together.
You don't hear together very often. There was a brief moment, Stryker and others, where heavy Christian heavy metal, you learn a lot writing a book. And he was going to a forgotten junior college that no one outside of Greenville South Carolina has ever heard of. And he had to pick a major, and he suddenly had a wife and a baby, and he had to have a job. So he said, oh, I'll be an accountant. The reason he was going to be an accountant, his dad was an accountant. He had no idea what his dad did, other than his dad hated his job. But that's what men do who have children. They have a job they hate, and accountants seem like a good one. He hated his classes. It took him 6 tries to pass the CPA exam. He was just lost. And then he finally passed the CPA exam. He was working as an accountant, and he just kept thinking, nobody wants what I do. Nobody is sitting there thinking, you know, I'd really love to file a tax return, or I'd really love an audit for my company, or I'd love to talk about payroll. All of his customers had to use him by law, and then he was charging them by the hour, as if anyone was sitting there going, you know, I'd love an hour and 26 minutes of an accountant's time. Mm-hmm. That's what I really want for my birthday. So he just had this vague idea. What if I delighted my customers? What if I provided a service that they loved? And he didn't know what that meant. It took him 10 or 15 years to figure it out. But he slowly built this model of realizing that something he was really good at was working with creative folks. Graphic designers, musicians, web designers, who are really good at being creative but terrible at money. I think we probably know a lot of people like that. And growing up in West Beth and Greenwich Village, there's a ton of people like that. And helping them think about money in a way that they related to. And he realized people really need that. People really love that. And so he built a business around that and went from having hundreds of customers who didn't pay, where he wasn't making that much money, to having 40 customers where he was making far more money because he was adding so much value that they were willing to pay for it.
And so that's one of your rules, is only create value that can't easily be copied.
That can't easily be copied. Yeah. If you do want to be a billionaire, if you want to like compete with Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk, then probably you have to have a huge scale business that everyone on earth will pay you money for. But if you want to have a solid lifestyle business, you know, everyone in the book makes, you know, good income, some of them in the 6 figures, some in the 7 figures. None of them are wildly rich, but they all are comfortable and happy. But their work really fuels them and feeds them. And that's the idea. That's how the global trade and outsourcing and all of that, it can disrupt what exists, but it also allows you, just like podcasting does, just like being an online accountant, because he works with his clients all over the country and all over the world, digitally mostly, allows you to connect with people everywhere in the world, so you don't need to just serve everyone in your community as a generalist. You can be a super specialist. That's why Jason Blummer always says, you can never niche too narrowly. You should always have a very specific narrow niche.
All right. We're going to try not to drive this segment into a dish.
Okay.
And we're going to continue in a minute with Adam Davidson, New Yorker staff writer, co-founder of NPR's Planet Money. And we'll have time for a couple of phone calls for him. Does anyone have a passion economy story that helps to prove his point, or a question for Adam Davidson on the ideas in his new book, The Passion Economy, The New Rules for Thriving in the 21st Century? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Stay with us.
If you're planning on getting rid of your old car in the coming months, please consider donating it to WNYC. We'll turn that old car into the in-depth news, reporting, and programs you count on. Donating your car is a great way to support WNYC, and you'll get a tax deduction at the same time. We'll even tow it away for free. Find out more about how to donate your car at wnyc.org/car.
Support for WNYC comes from Kripalu Center for Yoga and Health, a retreat center in the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts that offers tools for mind-body wellness. Information at kripalu.org. The New Jersey Performing Arts Center, presenting Joshua Bell and Academy of St. Martin in the Fields with a program of Beethoven, Paganini, and Brahms, Friday, February 21st at 8 p.m. Tickets at njpac.org. Support for The Brian Lehrer Show is provided in part by the Endeavor Foundation.
Now you can tune into WNYC without the tuning. All you need is your voice and a smart speaker. Just say, play WNYC, and you'll hear your favorite radio shows. Learn how at WNYC.org/smartspeaker.
And coming up at noon on All of It, Allison Stewart speaks with comedian Maria Bamford about her new special, Weakness is the Brand. Plus, a conversation about sexual assault on college campuses and why it's so misunderstood. That's coming right up at noon on 93.9 FM, AM 820, or ask your smart speaker to play WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Adam Davidson, whose new book is The Passion Economy, The New Rules for Thriving in the 21st Century. I'm curious to get your quick take on the two big Trump trade deals in the news this week, the USMCA, or new NAFTA, passing Congress with Democratic support, and the China agreement announced yesterday that Trump says will open China to more U.S. exports and protect our intellectual property there. Winners?
But I mean, well, I think we now know the Trump strategy is to create an artificial crisis, create an artificial solution, and then declare victory. So these are not, you know, when Bill Clinton signed the allowed for
NAFTA?
China to enter
China.
The WTO,
uh-huh. Yep.
It really was a transformation, a restructuring of our global economy in a very real way. I mean, what I like to say is, China instantly added as many people as existed. It doubled the size of the global economy and had a huge and radical impact on everything. I personally don't believe NAFTA. I think its impact is very oversold and was not nearly as either disastrous or helpful. I think most of the economic data shows it was a moderate success, but not anything major. But China was transformative. Very few people will notice any difference in their business or lives because of this. I will say that there's something Trump does that is extremely dangerous, which is, and it's something, this is one thing presidents have done forever, is favor certain industries specifically for political reasons. That's the opposite of what we need. I mean, in my view, we're moving from that widget economy that employed lots and lots of people, and the way you succeeded was signing yourself up with a big corporation that was succeeding in the widget economy, to an economy where each of us is more of an independent actor. And to the, and that's a transition that's going to take a generation or more to adjust to, and may go well, may go poorly. I think it can go well for some people right away. But anyway, but for Trump to favor certain industries and focus on certain industries, it actually slows down that transition time and just hurts our economy in the long run.
Jim in Park Slope has a niche economy business, I think. Hi, Jim.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Doing well. And let me correct that, because Adam said when we got into the whole niche thing, he doesn't like the word in the first place. It's more passion economy, which is the theme of the book. But Jim, go ahead.
So I am in the middle of a very passionate, creative universe, costume culture, we call it, because it's involved with Burning Man, cosplay, a whole bunch of things. And we're launching a new platform called Costume Network that brings all sorts of passionate people together. And just want to ask your advice, targeting niches and so forth, because so many venture capitalists look for these broad-based things, and it's very encouraging to hear that that it's about focused niche projects now.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember, it's not in the book, but I remember interviewing a guy who really focused on wigs for the drag community. He's a drag performer himself in Australia, and has made a really decent business because he identified this very specific need that a very specific group of people desperately want. Now, that's the key piece in my mind, going from like a hobby or an art form to an actual business, is identifying who is the customer? What does the customer want? So, but that can only come in a case like yours from really intimately understanding that community and understanding what problems you can solve, what enhancements you can bring. So to me, that sounds like a very good path. I'll also just quickly say, because this is a recent obsession of mine, it's not in the book because I just started thinking about it with some other people recently, is that I do think we're going to have multiple markets, not just eBay and Amazon have everything, but rather there may be markets for specific groups, and markets themselves will be clearing houses and gathering places for specific niches. So I really like that idea. That's actually a hot VC thing right now, is multiple markets. So, but I hate VC money generally. I think it's a bad idea for most investors.
Let's take one more, because he's in an industry that I didn't expect to see on the board in this context. John in Glen Cove, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you?
Good. And we're running out of time, so right to the point. Go for it.
Sure. The funeral industry is being purchased by a corporation, so the independent operator can no longer purchase a funeral home. They either have to work for a funeral home or go into another business. One of the reasons I called, because you kept saying about niche. In my business, there is certainly something called a niche where you put cremains in it. But my question is, with all these companies that are purchasing these small funeral homes and turning them into one large conglomerate, what's the future of my business? Or when you compare it to some of the other businesses that you've spoken about.
So I do think that you're exactly the case where there is going to be opportunity. That I've unfortunately had to deal with some funerals recently, and there is a sameness, a lack of competition, a lack of specialness when you go to a funeral home. You do feel like you're at the tail end of some massive corporation. And
people are vulnerable at that time, and they
absolutely
can easily be taken advantage of.
The challenge is geographically located businesses like dry cleaners or the bodega that serves a specific area generally have to be fairly generalists. So I'd have to think a bit about how can a funeral home serve a broader audience, because the bigger geography you can serve, the more narrow you can go, because there's more people that you can choose from. But I would say broadly, I would think it's a classic case where there's tons of needs not being met by the big players.
Not where I expected we would end, but it is. Adam Davidson, New Yorker staff writer, co-founder of NPR's Planet Money, CEO of the podcast production company 3 Uncanny 4, and now the author of The Passion Economy, The New Rules for Thriving in the 21st Century. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.